Okay, so we've been looking at the refuge tree, and we've been looking at Sangha Rachita and some of his teachers, and we're now on to the, Kachu Rinpoche, the irrepressible, which sounds good to me. A bit like monkey. So Kachu Rinpoche. Kachu Rinpoche, the first thing that I noticed actually when I was preparing for this talk is there's not a tremendous amount written about his biography. And I thought, oh, well, I should look on the web and try and find out about a few more things. But actually, maybe we don't need to know. And but if anyone did get really interested in this figure and wanted to find some information about him, that would be really great. But as far as I know, he was born in 1920, probably in southern Tibet, and he's the eighth incarnation of Lhatsen Rinpoche, who was the man who introduced Buddhism into Sikkim. So quite a major figure, really, in Buddhist history, and he was his eighth incarnation. So we kind of get a bit of a picture about him, that he was a man of great learning, great talent, great spiritual practice, that he was fairly high up, actually, in the Tibetan Buddhist world. And he was deeply committed to the Buddhist way of life. And he's probably been deeply committed to the Buddhist way of life right from childhood, being an incarnation of someone quite so famous. And when Sangha Rachita met Kachu Rinpoche, he was the abbot of the royal monastery in Sikkim. So it's quite a big position, actually. And he performed the Buddhist functions for the Maharaja of Sikkim. The other thing about Kachu Rinpoche was that he was the chief disciple of one of Sangha Rachita's teachers, who's Jamyang Kyetse Rinpoche. Now, Jamyang Kyetse Rinpoche is probably one of the 20th century's most famous, most renowned Buddhist teachers coming out of Tibet. He's a very, very big figure. Have any of you heard of Sogyal Rinpoche? Yeah, he wrote Tibetan Book of Living and Dying. And Jamyang Kyetse Rinpoche was one of his teachers. So Sogyal Rinpoche probably knew Kachu Rinpoche as well. I don't know that. But you kind of get this impression that he's a man of great learning, a man of great talent. He was quite in there with the establishment of the Tibetan Buddhist world. He was a well-known and respected teacher, a chief disciple of someone who was really, really well-known. You know, he was no small fry, was Kachu Rinpoche. He was the real deal. And he's in the middle. We've got pictures of all Sangha Rachita and his teachers. And Kachu Rinpoche is the gentleman in the middle. And you can see, if you look at his face, he looks very elegant. He looks very kind of well-chiseled cheekbones. I should imagine he's quite good-looking, actually. And quite kind of aristocratic and noble-looking. So that's one impression of Kachu Rinpoche that we kind of get from hearing the facts about his life. But we also have another source of information about Kachu Rinpoche, and that is anecdotal stories, which are really quite interesting and portray quite a different picture, in fact. So the first one we had, and this is how Sangha Rachita was introduced to Kachu Rinpoche, was Sangha Rachita knew a French Buddhist nun called Annie La. And you get the impression that Annie La was a bit of a difficult woman. But anyway, that's probably, he hints at it, he never says quite how. But one day, Annie La met Kachu Rinpoche in the woods. And Kachu Rinpoche was waiting to become abbot of this royal monastery in Sikkim. But he had to wait till the right day when he could enter the monastery. He had to wait for the auspicious day. So he was basically camping out there for a couple of days before he could enter the monastery. And she came upon him and she said, oh, how wonderful, you know, here's a Rinpoche, here's a Tibetan teacher. I'll go and talk to him. So they exchanged the usual greetings and he said to her, well, you know, who ordained you? She was ordained by Dadu Rinpoche, who we've heard about. And he said, oh, good. And what practice are you doing? And she said, well, I've been doing this and this practice. And he said, no, you're not. You haven't done that practice for 6 months.
Ooh.
This is my absolute fear, is someone can read my mind and knows exactly how much I really do the mindfulness of breathing and all the rest of it. So watch out. When I develop my telepathic skills, none of you will be safe. No, it's a joke. I'll have so much compassion then it won't matter. So one of the things that we find out is that Kashu Rinpoche must have been, to a certain extent, at least telepathic. And there's another thing. Sangharakshita became friends with Kashu Rinpoche, and he became his. He did a bit of interpreting for him because Sangharakshita could speak Nepali. And Kashu Rinpoche couldn't speak a word of English. And one day there was this American couple, and Sangharakshita was interpreting for Kashu Rinpoche. And the American couple were asking him very, very tricky, knotty questions about enlightenment and all these kind of really deep metaphysical things. And Sangharakshita noticed something very, very odd was going on. And what he realized was that actually Kashu Rinpoche was not waiting for him to translate what the Americans had asked. He was just answering them. And Kashu Rinpoche couldn't speak a word of English. So he must have just been telepathically knowing what they were asking and answering them. So that gives another slightly strange impression of Kashu Rinpoche. So Sangharakshita says, well, Kashu Rinpoche was, in fact, a great meditator. He said, apart from Yogi Chen, who we had last week, he was probably Sangharakshita's teachers, he was the greatest meditator. And not only was he a great meditator, but he really relied on inspiration from his meditation. So one day, Kashu Rinpoche was staying with Sangharakshita in Sangharakshita's vihara, or what is the translation of vihara? Dwelling place. Anyway, he was staying with Sangharakshita in Kalimpong, in northern India, and Sangharakshita was having breakfast with him after the morning meditation, and Kashu Rinpoche said to him, well, you see, in my meditation this morning, I saw that you've got to have a banner of victory. So we've got to spend the day putting a banner of victory up on your roof. So getting a banner of victory up on Sangharakshita's roof was not like going down to the local shop and buying a banner of victory and sort of, you know, lobbing it up there. There's this long description of what they had to do. They had to go to the carpenter. They had to get a frame made. They had to go to the cloth merchant and buy some cloth. They had to go to the tailor and get him to stitch it. And then Kashu Rinpoche had to climb up on the roof and touch it there. And if you've got a carpenter to make it, I should imagine it was pretty big. But they did it. They did it all because it had appeared in Kashu Rinpoche's meditation. And why not? And the other thing that Kashu Rinpoche gave Sangharakshita, the Padmasambhava visualization practice. But he also gave him something else. He gave him the title of Urgyen. So Urgyen is a kind of Tibetan word for Udayana, which is the mythical place of Padmasambhava's birth, the lake of Udayana. So I don't, as far as I understand, you don't just give someone the name Urgyen just because they've taken up Padmasambhava practice. You don't just do it like that. And I reckon, reading between the lines and my own interpretation, I reckon Kashu Rinpoche saw something about Sangharakshita. He saw something about Sangharakshita and just out of that inspiration decided to give him this title, Urgyen. It's quite a strong thing to call someone, actually, because it's almost, to me, it's almost like saying, you've got the job of Padmasambhava in the world. And what's really interesting is that, I mean, Sangharakshita, is a very big kind of Padmasambhava devotee. Well, what was interesting is that later when Sangharakshita came to England, and he was talking, he was giving a public lecture, and there was a woman in the audience who was quite sort of in touch with a bit of a mythical world, if you see what I mean. And she said to him afterwards, she said, it was really odd when you were talking because I could just see this figure behind you. And this figure was kind of slightly Indian, slightly Chinese looking, but he looked a bit like a magician or something. He had this long flowing black hair and all these implements and all this silk and everything. And well, it was Padmasambhava. She'd seen a vision of Padmasambhava behind Sangharakshita. So I always think that's quite interesting. I think Kashu Rinpoche saw something then, and that's why he gave him the title Urgyen. So if Sangharakshita sends out a letter or something on his headed notepaper, it says, He's quite often called the Venerable Urgyen Sangharakshita. He still uses that title to this day. So anyway, so we've got this impression of Khatri Rinpoche that on the one hand, he was a well-respected tulku, an incarnation of a renowned Buddhist, a senior disciple of a renowned Buddhist. He was abbot of a royal monastery. And on the other hand, there he was, climbing on a roof, putting up a banner of victory because he saw it in his meditation. And in fact, Sangharakshita says of him, he said, well, even though he was my teacher, he was a great friend. And Khatri Rinpoche never stood on ceremony. He was always very warm-hearted, very kind, very open person. And he wasn't polished or elegant, even though he had all this kind of status in a way in the Buddhist world. He was never undone by it. He was never polished or elegant. Sangharakshita said he actually was quite rough and ready. And he used to just turn up at Sangharakshita's with his sleeping mat and just kip down on the floor. You know, so this is not the mark of someone who's, you know, a big regal person. Actually, he just was quite ordinary, quite down to earth, but a very, very serious practitioner. And he really lived on this kind of thread of inspiration from his meditation practice. So, well, what can we take from this? What can we take from Khatri Rinpoche? And I think we can take something quite important to this. And this is something that's been going through my mind a lot recently in regards to my meditation practice. And the frightening thing is that the more I reflect on this area, the more it's working. One should not be surprised when the Dharma actually works. Anyway, and what we can take for it is that actually most of the time we're acting from a habitual mind. Most of the time we're acting from a habitual kind of commentary that we have about life and its events. You know, so there's a writer called Alan Wallace, and he talks about the conceptual mind. The conceptual mind that thinks about the past and plans for the future. You know, that gets anxious about things that might or might not happen. That's always interpreting things and putting certain lights on things and dealing with things in terms of your likes and dislikes. All that kind of habitual chatter and habitual ways of making decisions. Sometimes they're based on solid fact and sometimes they're just based on speculation. But there's always this habitual mind that's running through life that we make decisions on the basis of. And in a way, that's fine. We all need that habitual mind, otherwise we wouldn't be able to get up out of bed in the morning. You know, we wouldn't be able to make a cup of coffee, we wouldn't be able to get to the Buddhist Center. So this kind of habitual mind, it enables us to make decisions, it enables us to actually live our lives. Otherwise we just couldn't function in the world. But the problem about that is it doesn't leave a lot of space. And it doesn't leave a lot of space for something else to emerge. Because actually there's another mode of operating, and there's another mode of operating where we quietly attend to something without that kind of commentary. So it's not as if you're not making choices, because you do make choices. You still make a choice about drawing out the positive and letting go of the negative in your mind. But it's a quieter mind. There's a possibility for a quieter, stiller mode of operating in our mind. Where you start to focus on what's actually going on here and now. And more importantly, in this quieter, stiller mind, where you're aware of what's going on in the moment, you're also receptive to something else emerging. And that's meditation. So in some ways, meditation is about receptivity. It's about action. It's about making a conscious choice to go behind the skillful mental states and to abandon the unskillful mental states. But it's also about being receptive to something else emerging. And Khatri Rinpoche shows us what can happen if we are receptive to a different mode of being, if we are receptive to a different state of consciousness, to a higher state of consciousness. And he really trusted his meditation. He lived from his meditation. He expressed his meditation all the time. And I think actually that's possible for all of us. I don't think that acting from your deeper inspiration is something that's just for Tibetan Rinpoches. Because I think this is what I've been really reflecting on recently. And what I've been reflecting on recently is actually that the main thing that's holding us all back from higher states of consciousness is the fact that we don't believe that they're possible. On some level, there's a doubt there that a higher mode of operating is possible. And what it goes like is something like this. You know, I sit down to meditate, and I'm used to a habitual state of mind in my meditation practice. So, you know, I might say, well, I'm not a great meditator. You know, something like that. I'm not a great meditator. I'll sit down to meditate, and I'll think, right, okay. Well, you know, what's going to happen in my meditation is pretty much this. There's going to be a little monkey in my mind who's just going to witter on quietly in the background. And I kind of just have that expectation. And so what happens in my meditation is a quiet, well, not so quiet, a little monkey just witters on gently in the background until I get up and make myself a cup of tea. And I think that all happens basically because I've got an expectation that it will happen. And usually when we have an expectation about something like that, we confine ourselves and that's what's going to happen. This is my meditation, that's what's going to happen. Nothing else is going to happen because nothing else really could. Because this is me and Vajratara, you know, she's all right, but she's not exactly the most focused of person, people. So, if you could let go of that idea and just open yourself up to the possibility that something greater that could happen, that you could actually operate from a deeper mode of being, that you could get in higher states of consciousness, those things can emerge. You've left space for those things to emerge. So I'm going to give you a rough outline, and this is quite a sort of rough outline really, of what can happen in your meditation. A very, very traditional list called the dhyanas. And they mean sort of higher states of consciousness. It's written up here with a DH. Or in Pali, it's a JH, I think. Or just a J. Whatever. So what happens in meditation is the first thing is you have a kind of balance between a bright, joyful energy that can put its weight behind the positive mental states and abandon the negative mental states. So a kind of bright, joyful energy that's prepared to make a bit of effort. There's a balance between that energy and also a deep calm that just quietly attends to what's going on. A deep calm that just watches things arising and relaxes into those things arising, relaxes into its own experience. So there's a balance between energy and calm. And out of that comes something called neighbourhood or access concentration. The mind starts to become more malleable. You become more interested in the meditation. And instead of your thoughts and emotions, you know, being at completely different ends of the spectrum and pulling in different directions, they actually cooperate. Your thoughts cooperate with your meditation because they're interested. Your emotions cooperate with their meditation because they're fulfilled. And, you will have some distractions, but they won't exert the same emotional pull. They'll be easy to just put down. You can just put down those distractions when they arise. And that brings you on to the first dhyana, or the state of integration. So this list is actually from Sangharakshita. He's got different ways of, sort of different words to describe each stage, which I think are really helpful, actually. And in the stage of integration, our conflicting selves unite. So often we find in life that we're, in a way, we're kind of different people, different personalities in different circumstances. You might be quite a different person at work than you are at home. And you might be quite a different person at home than you are at the Buddhist centre. But I think it's more than that, because I experience these different, I'm not mad as far as I know, but I do experience different personalities even in the space of one meditation practice. I can be sitting there getting quite concentrated, quite happy to be there. And then before I know it, I'm kind of making a cup of tea and watching the telly. And I think, how did I get from there to there? And it's almost like there's different parts of my being. There's some bits of me that want to go for it, really meditate, really get somewhere, go to the Buddhist center, really practice. And there's some part of me that's basically just a bit lazy and wants to watch the TV or a bit bored. But in the stage of integration, what happens is that all those different personalities, they all come together. They integrate themselves around the object of concentration. So it's sort of easy to meditate. It's easy to become concentrated. your whole being is cooperating with you. Oh, what a relief. You know, there just isn't that conflict anymore. And your hindrances die away and you just feel quite happy. It's a state of happiness. You just feel really happy just to be there, really grateful just to be there in your meditation practice. And you feel happy not from some external stimulus. You feel happy because actually that happiness is coming from the depths of your own mind. So that integration, which is quite a positive state to be in, can lead on to a state of inspiration. And sometimes this is described as a clear spring bubbling up through the bottom of a lake. So it's like a clear spring of water permeating up through your being. And what this is a state of is lucid absorption. The discursive thoughts and chatter kind of die away. So the little monkey just, you know, goes off somewhere else. And you're left sustained by this inner flow of inspiration. So you know that thing about like artists and their muses, a kind of force of creativity and inspiration coming from a different place almost. That's apparently what it's a bit like. It's like this flow of inspiration just comes into your being like an underground spring. And you're more and more receptive to deeper levels of consciousness. Things start to emerge. Things start to change. You start to experience yourself in a different way. You start to experience yourself as creative and inspired. And in the next stage, well, that just carries on permeating your whole being. You become permeated by this deeper level of consciousness. So it's not like it's trickling in anymore. It's like you are it. You are creative and inspired. It's not just sort of welling up. It's there. You're it. And you feel much part of something much, much greater than your habitual mind. Your habitual mind's long gone. And you start to experience yourself as bigger, as a bigger, higher self. And the more that this happens, you get to a stage of radiation, where your state of consciousness is so purified by your inspiration and by your creativity that it's yours to take as a protection against the outside world, and it's also yours to influence the outside world. You can act from it. You can be it. You can become it in the world. So some people who are in this state of concentration, it's a bit like apparently if you walk into a room when someone's in that state, it's like you're walking into a room where the air is just really fresh. You can just pick it up off them immediately. It's like walking into a really bright, fresh, open space, like they've got a kind of cool breeze coming off them. And although we're not talking enlightenment here, they're still mundane states of consciousness. Well, what a great state to be in, and what a great effect to have on others. So, yes, so we've got the stages of integration, inspiration, permeation, and radiation. So what we can see is that actually as you progress through the dhyanas, as you get into higher and higher states of consciousness, it's characterized by higher and higher levels of emotional positivity. It's about pleasure, it's about joy, and it's about integrating that joy fully into your being and taking it out into the world. So Khatri Rinpoche, in a way, is an exemplar of this because he's so good-humoured. I imagine that he was a really, really likeable man, actually. A really kind, warm-hearted man. And and I think that's why he didn't have to stand on much ceremony. He knew who he was, and he was kind and open-hearted. And when you're kind and open-hearted, you don't have to stand on your position. It's all right for you to just bring a roll mat and kip on your mate's floor. Easy. But the other thing about going in these deeper and deeper states of consciousness is that it's characterized by more and more receptivity to higher states of mind that are different and higher than your usual discursive state of mind, your usual discursive habitual mind. And maybe it's characterized by receptivity to a mind that actually is higher than yours at all. Maybe it's not. It's so positive, it's so deep, that actually you wouldn't really recognise it as your own mind in quite the same way. It's not about you anymore so much. These states of consciousness are characterized by positivity and receptivity. And associated with those states of mind are experiences that are a little strange. So you've all had some of these probably, and they're called samapatis. And samapatis are experiences that you have on the basis of higher and higher concentration. So they start off with, some of them can be quite mundane. They can be kind of images rising in your head, lights. They could be that thing where you feel like you've got a massive hand or your body's twisted around. You know, so you can be sitting in meditation thinking you're facing one way, and then you open your eyes and you're facing completely a different direction. Or you feel like your whole back is doing a kind of weird spiral. That's mine, actually. I feel like my back's kind of... And I have to open my eyes and just check that I haven't done something really odd with my body or my spine's collapsed or something. But usually you're fine as you are. It's just your body kind of compensating for the lack of sensory stimulus and just making up kind of experiences. But there's other samapatis that are a bit higher than that, particularly associated with stage of radiation. And some of them can be really quite intense. People can have visions, quite emotionally charged visions. You can have flashes of insight where you really, really understand a teaching. It's not like, here we are at the Buddhist Center. We've told you all you need to know in the beginner's course, incidentally. All you need to know for enlightenment is in the beginner's course. But we have to keep telling you more and more stuff because people kind of forget about it. But every so often, you might have a flash of insight where you really, really, really get something. And what you really, really, really get is something that you heard on the beginner's course, basically. So, I don't know why you're all here. I'm a bit embarrassed, really, but you know. So, yeah. So, you could have flashes of insight and you might get the power of telepathy. Slightly frightening. But there you go. So it's not necessary that you get all these experiences. It's not necessary for enlightenment. And some people don't get these experiences. But some people, like Kachu Rinpoche, something else is going on with Kachu Rinpoche. And it's on the basis of deep meditation experience. So when he got these samapatis, when he got this kind of telepathy, when he got these visions, he didn't just go, that's not quite rational. That doesn't quite accord with my own sense of being a solid, upright individual, you know. He actually acted them out. He saw them as real. In some ways, he saw them as more real than his habitual mind, as his mind that chatters on as his discursive thoughts. He really acted those visions out, and he really lived by them. So, just to tie this up, really... What might Kachu Rinpoche come and say to you if he was here now? Well, he might say the first thing is to trust your mind. Trust that you are, as individuals, every single person in this room has the potential for a higher state of mind. That's far beyond the habitual mind that you're experiencing on a day-to-day level. Every single one of us. And if you really want to practice the spiritual life, you're going to have to start to get to know your mind to some extent. You're going to have to get this sense of believing in a bigger you than you are now. It's really important. It's really important that you believe in yourself. Because if you don't, you won't get there. If you don't believe in a higher vision of who you can become, you won't become that person. You won't become that vision. So what he might say to you is trust in your potential, see your potential. It's a bit like sometimes I get glimpses of your potential, otherwise I wouldn't be here. Sometimes I get glimpses of people's potential that you're so much greater than you think you can be. You're so much greater than that. I am as well. We're capable of infinite compassion, infinite wisdom, infinite energy. We're capable of higher states of being that we can only dream of now. And each person is capable of those things. And it doesn't matter what sex you are, it doesn't matter what colour you are, it doesn't matter what social group you come from. None of those things matter. You're all individuals. And you all have the potential not only for higher states of mind, but for enlightenment. And if you could go to bed every night and say that to yourself every morning, you'd be onto a winner. So I've got a bit of a quote here from Thomas Merton that says, what can we gain by sailing to the moon if we are not able to cross the abyss that separates us from ourselves? This is the most important of all voyages of discovery, and without it, all the rest are not only useless, but disastrous. So Kathy Rinpoche might say, try and go on a journey. Go on a bit of journey and discover things about yourself. Try and cross that abyss that separates you from your own mind. Play about with it a bit. Take a bit of light-hearted humour and experiment, because you don't know what you could find. And in a way, in that journey, what you're going to need is you're going to need to be receptive to that. You're going to need to be receptive to a higher state of mind emerging. Otherwise, it won't emerge. And you're going to need to act it out. When you have those kooky visions, when you have those dreams, those inspirations, those flashes of insight, whatever they may be, believe in them, act them out. Don't immediately brush them aside as being, well, you know, I haven't thought that through properly and blah, 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 blah. But actually just listen to that voice sometimes. Sometimes it's a bit like we've got a wee Buddha. We've got the monkey on one side. I don't know where this is. I didn't write this down, but anyway, it's coming out. So we've got the monkey on one side, and we've kind of got the Buddha on the other side, or Tara, or some other archetypal figure, who's actually like your higher self. And in a way, sometimes we need to just slow down and listen to that voice. Listen to that voice who knows who we are in our deepest nature, who believes in us. Listen to, why not have an experiment for a week and just listen to the voice that believes in you rather than listening to the voice that thinks you're rubbish? I think that's a much better way to do things, really. And, you know, he would say, live by your vision. We've all got a vision. We don't need to, in a way, we don't need to get into these higher states of consciousness to have a vision of who we can become. It helps. But actually, you've all got, to some extent, a vision of who you can become. And to try and live out that vision, live out a vision of a higher self, of a better self, of a self that's got limitless possibilities, rather than living out a vision of an old self or habitual self or a self who's a bit rubbish and can't do much. You know, put away the voice that says, I'm a bit of a rubbish meditator, and start believing in the voice that says, actually, I could become enlightened. Why not? So what we're going to do now is we're going to do a bit of an exercise to trust our vision. And to get a sense of who we might become and how to live by that vision. So we've done this before in the Buddhist Centre, but it's quite good, actually. When you've done it, you'll never forget it, because it's quite strong. So we're going to do this kind of little visualisation sort of exercise where we're going to meet our future self. On behalf of Kathy Rinpoche, we're going to meet our future selves. So you might need to get into a meditation posture. Okay, so we're just going to settle down and just prepare yourself for meditation. So bringing your awareness to your body. Relax your feet. Feeling any sensations of your feet against the floor. Any sensations in the soles of your feet or your toes? And moving up your shins and calf muscles, softening any tension, even relaxing into the knees. Relaxing the thigh muscles. and feeling your weight sinking into the cushions or the chair. So you have a strong and rooted base of your posture. And you can almost imagine that you've got roots stretching down into the earth, through the floor, through the stone, through the earth. And from that strong and rooted base, there's a sense of uplift and energy. So your back feels light, and it's upright but relaxed. And breathing out any tension in the stomach. Feeling the gentle rise and fall of your chest with your breath. Your shoulders drop, your arms become heavy. Feeling the sensations in your fingers and hands. And checking that your neck is balanced. Your face is soft. Relaxing any tension in your eyes, mouth and jaw. Maybe just spending a moment paying particular attention to your heart area, to the center of your chest. Maybe checking how you are. So the first thing we're going to do is to imagine in front of you an image of yourself, but of yourself in the future. Maybe yourself in 5 years' time, maybe 10 years, or maybe yourself as you are old. Maybe even as you approach death. But whatever distance away in the future, you are looking at your future wiser self. So this is the self you could become, the self you are going to become, the self that embodies all you could be. And try to look at this future self as clearly as possible. What do they look like? What are they wearing? What is the expression on their face? What do their eyes look like? What feelings shine out from their eyes? How are they holding their body? How would it feel to hold your body this way? How would it feel to be this person? What is the tone of their voice? How does it make people feel to hear this voice? How might they conduct themselves in the world? Now we see that between you and the future wiser you, there is a path leading into the future. Imagine yourself walking on this path. What lies along it? What do you need to do to walk this path? What changes do you need to make in your life or in your habits? What actions lie along this path? Walk along the path, noting what lies along it, to join your future wiser you. And when you have reached them, join with them, merge with them, become them, sit in their body, feel what it is like to be this person. And through the eyes of this new you, look back at your life as it is now. What do you learn? Now in your mind, retrace your steps back from the future, back to the present. Leave behind your future self until you step back into your body. But you have changed. Maybe you've seen a glimpse of your future before you. And if you like, you might still see your future wiser self sitting in a bright space in the center of your chest. You might see them as a small bright figure sitting in an open shell of light in the center of your chest. And try to see that figure as brightly, as warmly as possible. Because this is where your future wiser you always sits, advising you if you are only quiet enough to listen. And you might reflect that just as you have a future wiser self, so do others. Sitting in the hearts of all of us here are a glimpse of what we can become. And together they collectively make the future wiser self of humanity. They are all aspects of the Buddha, all facets of the same jewel, of the potential of humanity, potential of all beings. And with this in mind, we draw the meditation to a close.